Welcome, everyone. Welcome to this town hall. Thanks very much for joining us. I want to introduce our panelists today. We have Dean Lauren Warnick, the Austin O'Huey Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine. Many of you know that our testing laboratory has been built in the veterinary college, and we're very fortunate to have the diagnostic lab as part of our veterinary college, which does diagnosis and surveillance at scale, and has been able to scale up for this surveillance testing in collaboration with our partners at Cuga Health System. And I want to introduce Vice Provost Lisa Nishi, who's Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education. Lisa, as many of you know, has been overseeing our curriculum and revising much of our curriculum for the fall semester, and now beginning to think about the spring semester. And then finally, I'm very pleased to introduce and have with us JT Baker, who's our student elected trustee. JT is a senior this year, and JT is here to give us a lot of the student perspective on what's been going on. So before turning this back to Wendy Wolford, our host, I just want to give a couple of shout outs. Obviously, things have been going quite well for the last several weeks. And I do think that there are a number of people that are really responsible for things going so well. The first group of people, of course, are our students, because we hear so much in the press around the country that states that students really aren't capable of socially distancing, obeying rules, that sort of things. I've been on campus the last several weeks constantly, and I really see students social distancing, wearing masks, doing all the things that we've asked them to do, and taking a lot of pride in that. So I really want to begin by thanking our students. The second group that I want to thank are our employees, particularly those employees that are serving our students and are sort of front lines in this effort. Our dining workers, our custodians, individuals in our dorms and our dining halls. Also, our Statler workers who are taking care of students in isolation and quarantine. And then finally, the individuals in the laboratory, both individuals sampling our students, the people that we go to when we get sampled, and the individuals that are working around the clock in the laboratory to do the PCR and do the detection. So with that, I'll turn it back to Wendy, but I think we all owe those groups of people a great amount of thanks. Wendy?
Thanks, Mike, and good afternoon, everybody. It's great to have you here. So we got many questions in advance. We got about 50 questions in advance, some of which were just people saying thank you, which was really nice. The rest of the questions, we'll try to address them as we go as possible. But as always, of course, submit questions in the Q&A box and panelists will answer them as they can. And also we'll try to incorporate them into the questions, oral questions. All of the slides presented will be available afterwards, and the recording will be on the COVID website. Those were two questions that came up beforehand. Okay, we're going to start with Lauren. Many of the questions submitted beforehand were on testing, understandably. So the first one is that we seem to be doing so well in terms of our low positive numbers. Will testing frequencies be reduced at any point? And if so, what is the threshold for that to occur?
Thanks, Wendy. I really appreciate being able to represent the COVID-19 testing committee and the laboratory and sampling teams that are conducting the testing program for the campus. It's been an amazing effort, and that has involved literally hundreds of people across the university to pull this together. And I thank everyone who's pitched in to make it happen. Before commenting on the testing frequency, I thought it might be good to just very quickly summarize where we're at right now, and that's a good context for where we're going. So as you know, the PCR testing is being done, as Mike said, in a new laboratory that's housed in the College of Veterinary Medicine. And this new lab was done as a collaboration with Cayuga Health Systems. And it was really built on the expertise of the Animal Health Diagnostic Center, which conducts well over 1 million tests a year. And building on that experience, Dr. Diego Diel, Kim Potter, Francois Elvinger, and their team were able to put this amazing lab together. Next slide, please. As was reported in an earlier town hall, we first started with arrival and baseline testing. This was done from May through the end of August and had nearly 19,000 individual people tested with 31 positive. The surveillance testing started in earnest on September 3rd, and to date, the surveillance testing samples have amounted to nearly 94,000 samples collected and tested. And of those, 28 have been positive. So that's 0.03% of the samples tested. And that represents about 22,000 individuals, roughly 17,000 students and about 5,000 staff and faculty. During that same time period, there's also been tests done by Cornell Health. If people had symptoms, if they were contacts of test positive individuals or adaptive testing. And that's been just over 800 people tested with 40 positive or about 5%. And of course we would expect the percent positive to be higher for that group because of having symptoms or having been in contact with someone who is infected. Next slide, please. So this slide shows the number of positive cases per day going back to August 17th. And this includes both surveillance test results as well as for-cause tests. And the slide actually shows really two important messages. One is a cautionary story, which as you see starting about the end of August as case numbers increases, it shows how quickly this virus can spread in the right circumstances. And you've seen either from Tompkins County Health Department press releases or from university messages, some of the reasons for that led to that spread. But the other message is a very positive one. And that shows the success of the public health program on campus, and that with wearing masks, social distancing, limiting gatherings, and limiting travel, and combining that with testing, contact tracing, quarantine, and quick follow-up, that the spread can be limited. So thank you, we can stop the slides now. So back to the question on sampling frequency. It's good where we're at now, and I think it really speaks to how everybody's dedicated themselves to make this all work. But there are some changes on the horizon. There may be some differences in what kind of gatherings are allowed. We'll have cooler weather and more people indoors. The local K through 12 schools, some of those are being open for in-person classes. So because of this, it's the feeling of the testing committee right now that we should stay the course and build on the success we've had so far, and keep our current test frequency for likely through the next 2 months and until Thanksgiving. The case numbers, of course, will be evaluated over time through the fall, and then working with Cornell Health, Tompkins County Health Department, and Cayuga Medical will make a decision about the future. But we think that in the intercession, you know, after Thanksgiving and during the semester break, testing should continue for sure, but we may make some adjustments in how frequently it's done. So that's where we stand right now and what we see for the future coming up. So thanks, Wendy.
Okay, great. So can you just elaborate a little bit on that last part there about surveillance testing continuing for students and staff? who may be here after Thanksgiving, over the winter, and even into the start of the new semester. Will the testing capacity and facilities continue?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The same sort of sampling approach and laboratory capacity and everything will be available during that time. And as we know more about how many students are staying in the area, how many are traveling away, that kind of thing, then we'll make a decision about the frequency of sampling. But it'll be a similar infrastructure to what we have right now.
Okay, and a quick question from Carl Frank. I know you've answered this before, but can you just really quickly explain again what adaptive testing is?
Yeah, so adaptive testing is something that we're doing at Cornell, where when the health department identifies contacts through contact tracing, there are individuals who may be part of the network of a positive case, say living in the same area or working in the same unit, that kind of thing, who are not classified as contacts, but we still think it would be a good idea to do extra testing. And so that's where adaptive testing is used, to get an extra sample in addition to what would be done through the normal surveillance.
Okay, thanks. Here's a question that I've had myself, and it came up beforehand. What happens, we're entering flu season or cold season, what happens with a daily check if you have a symptom that you really believe is not a COVID symptom? You think it's allergy or it's a cold, you have a cough. What happens with the daily check and with testing?
Yeah, so everybody coming to campus, and of course all students should be doing the daily check. And if they have symptoms, they should answer that question as a yes. And that will lead for students a conversation with Cornell Health, for employees a conversation with Cayuga Medical Center, and there'll be a medical professional who will evaluate the situation and advise on whether it might be related to COVID, whether they should go to the mall for testing, that kind of thing. Now, importantly, if it's determined that that's something like allergies that could have similar symptoms but is not COVID-19, once that initial conversation has been had, then the next time you go into the daily check, it'll lead you through an algorithm that kind of deals with those more chronic situations. So you don't have to keep calling up day after day about the same thing. So that's all built into the system. Very importantly is, of course, not to come to campus if you're sick. And if someone is ill and wants to get tested, they should not come to one of our regular surveillance sampling sites, but should go to the, for faculty and staff, for example, could go to the Cayuga Mall to get a sample there.
Great, thanks, Lauren. Mike, can I throw one to you about flu season, and how should faculty and staff treat flu season, and what sort of guidance is available?
Well, everybody should get flu vaccine. We're providing flu vaccine on campus, and one of the proposals now, and I think you'll see in the next couple of weeks, flu stations set up near our testing stations. So it's really important that we get immunity on campus to flu, and I would urge everybody to get vaccinated for flu. The flu vaccine is not 100% effective, but it is very, very effective. And the concordance of the flu season with our ongoing pandemic raises significant challenges for us, as is mentioned in the last question and Lauren's answer, around diagnosis, around treatment, et cetera. So this is mandatory for individuals coming to campus, and everybody should get a flu vaccine as soon as possible.
Okay, thanks. Back to Lauren about people modifying their testing days. So one person wrote beforehand, Some months I'm on campus three times, other months I don't come to campus at all. What should I do for testing? Can I make a test for a day when I know I'll be on campus or for the day prior? And David Williamson asks if we can change our testing dates to align with our teaching schedule.
Yeah, so there's several options for people, and this has been one of the most frequent questions, is the first, when you go into the daily check, there is an option to change your testing day. So that would be the first thing to try to see if you can align it with your schedule. The second thing is if you are in a testing schedule that doesn't match with your how frequently you come to campus. So let's say somebody's schedule once a week, but they're really here very rarely. That person could talk to their HR rep and be changed to the every other week schedule rather than once a week. And then the third thing is if someone, especially for kind of one-off situations where the testing schedule just doesn't align, or people have family commitments or other things that makes it impossible to come in, if just let a department chair, supervisor, or your unit or college HR group know, so that as they get notification that tests were missed, they know already that there's an explanation for that, and then there wouldn't be any adverse consequences in that case. So I think those options will allow most people to, you know, fit into the schedule they need, and then if there's individual one-off situations, those could be addressed. I do want to remind everybody that East Hill Plaza has a testing site that is set up for faculty and staff specifically. And so that's a good one where you've got parking right nearby and can get out in and out quickly for your test.
And another one that just came up in the Q&A, if they're doing surveillance testing and the answer is negative, will they get any sort of response?
Yeah, so the people are not being contacted individually in any way if they get a negative test result. So if you don't hear anything, that's good news. You can go into the Cayuga Health Systems portal and check your results, you know, as long as you remember your right login information and all that. But you should assume if you don't hear back, then you've had a not detected result. Go on with your work, school, whatever. And then certainly if there's a positive result, then there would be a call from Tompkins County Health Department to follow up on that.
Thanks, Lauren. One last question on testing. What is the procedure if someone needs to miss a surveillance test due to some reason other than having COVID?
Yeah, it'd be what I mentioned before, just let a supervisor, department chair, or your unit HR representative know that you've had to miss a test, unforeseeable circumstances, that kind of thing. If you miss on one day, I think there is some leeway to register the following day. So that could be tried, but if it's something where you're just not gonna be able to get in for that test, then let someone know so they know the reason for that.
Okay, thanks. Still related to testing, but now moving to the dashboard, there were several questions that came in beforehand and they sort of boiled down to two distinct things. You know, we've gotten a lot of really good feedback on the dashboard, but some people wrote in to say that they believe that the state guidelines dictated that the 100 number should be calculated as a rolling total over 14 days, as opposed to going back to zero on every 15th day. So Mike, can you clarify, please?
Sorry, yes, we also thought that, and would be a logical interpretation, but the state has been very clear. They issued new directives directly to the universities. They want these periods of blocks of time. So it does reset every 14 days and will continue to be calculating it on that basis, which is what the state has asked us to do. I would just say in a broader way, I mean, this is a more general, the state guidelines are more general guidelines for all colleges and universities in the state. I would pay, we spent a lot of time thinking about our alert levels, the metrics behind those alert levels, and I would pay particular attention to that. And then on the dashboard, I also saw a concern that we're not showing all of the data. We're only showing a subset of the data. And you can scroll back on the bar graph below and get previous data. We've just had some technical problems in showing all the data. If you show all the data, then the numbers get so small that you can't read it. And this was our sort of workaround to be able to get as much data as possible. But you know, everything is there, all the information is there, and obviously our prevalence currently is very, very low. As Lauren said, we're now well below 1%, and that's really great news. We're actually well below 0.1%, excuse me.
Okay, you answered my two dashboard questions at once, so I'm gonna ask you one more question. The testing has been going so well, prevalence is so low. There was a question about whether we will be easing restrictions on in-person gatherings or allowing for more types of gathering. Can you respond to that, please?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we do want to start to, we've been all along really trying to balance two things. One is, of course, protecting the community and keeping prevalence low. On the other hand, creating a kind of experience for students, a community for students that is important for residential instruction. We will be now gradually beginning over the next couple of weeks, you'll be hearing some relaxations of some areas of campus life. So there'll be some facilities that will be opening by student campus life on a selected, limited level. Then there'll be, you'll look forward to as we go further in the semester, some activities that are open. So we've had no club activities or those kinds of activities heretofore, but those will start to be allowed. Again, consistent with our social distancing, mask wearing, and the total limit on the number of individuals that are involved. So stay tuned for that. You'll start to hear that. And it's important to begin to, as much as possible, provide the kind of campus experience that we all want.
So speaking of the student experience, a couple of questions for JT. Students are taking many, if not all, of their classes over Zoom from their apartments or dorm rooms or family residences. Can you tell us a little bit about what your experience has been like this semester, or what you're hearing from your friends, and what Cornell can do to provide more of the social experience that's missing due to the absence of normal classroom interactions?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. And it's definitely been a very unique time being a student at Cornell. But I think one thing I want to mention, students are really appreciative that Cornell's open. I think that we're all fortunate and grateful to be back on campus when a lot of institutions decided not to go forward and to keep their campuses closed. And yes, it's a lot of Zoom. I personally have no in-person classes, so I'm on Zoom all the time, every day, and I'm ultimately in my apartment 24/7. And that's the first thing. I think a lot of students have this similar experience. And the first problem I would say is from a mental health standpoint. I think that Cornell needs to really take an intentional look at mental health from a professional standpoint, right? So the resources that we can have are more counselors, more faculty, and then also proactive. I think a lot of students may have mental health issues going on or be affected from that perspective and not even know, right? And I've kind of caught myself in that. A couple of days ago, I just kind of felt in a slump. I wasn't feeling like myself. And I just realized, you know, I've been in my apartment for 2 days straight on Zoom. I need to get out and work out. So really having, you know, faculty understand that, administration understand that, and also that it's a community-wide effort. I think that faculty and professors have been doing a great job. They've been very flexible and understanding with students. And I think that's what we really need to continue doing. during this time. And to answer your question about the social piece, I think it's hard, right? I think a lot of students would love to be able to go to dining halls and go to social events and parties, but we realize we can't, and not in today's environment, and we want to keep the community safe. There's just really no social aspect like that we're used to. So the only other thing would be, you know, my suggestion is virtual events, but then that kind of is counterintuitive because there's so much Zoom and so much computers that I don't think that would really be beneficial to students as well.
Yeah, it's tough. I do know SDL has an incredible amount of virtual programming, so I hope students are able to access that and have been taking part. I'm wondering, in terms of your classes, if there are things you're finding to be easier about online classes than you thought would be, or any particular innovations that you wanted to highlight.
Absolutely. I think two positive things is that classes online, especially when professors record their lectures or video notes, are very helpful. Students have time to go back and relearn material, spend deeper time on material that otherwise, if it was in person, they'd only get one time, and then that would be that. I think I love that as a student. The second thing, professors sometimes kind of make the assumption that because we are in this online environment and we're in quarantine, that students have more time than they usually would. And this is something that I've even experienced and a lot of students have told me, is that they've kind of been overloaded with work and overloaded with videos and lectures, just due to the assumption that, you know, students are in quarantine. So professors think that, okay, they can watch, you know, another 30 minutes of videos or another hour of reading. And students sometimes feel overwhelmed by that. So just kind of keeping that in the back of faculty and staff mind is that students are taking full course loads. They're required to do the same amount of work, just it's in an online setting. So those would be my two kind of biggest points that I've seen so far.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thanks, JT. Not to move from student well-being to exams too quickly, but a question for Lisa on exams. Do we know yet when the evening prelims will be held? And questions about whether faculty can hand out paper exams at that time? And questions about online exams and best practices for ensuring academic integrity, particularly for large online classes.
Sure. So the prelim schedule, you asked about the evening prelim schedule, that has actually been posted and available for a few weeks now. It's on the, I put it in one of the Q&A answers, but it's on the University Registrar's website. As far as, you know, the part about can you hand out paper exams if you're giving an in-person exam, yes, you can hand out paper exams. Of course, you know, anybody who's handing out those exams, we recommend that you thoroughly disinfect your hands first. But overall, my understanding is that the risk of paper-based transmission is thought to be quite low. But I think to be prudent, maybe avoid having students pass the exams down the aisle, as sometimes we do. I'm wondering, because the prelim schedule has been available for a while, if the question may have actually been about semi, or if people also have questions about semi-final exams. We have not yet posted the schedule for that. Really looking carefully at the data right now, now that the ad period is closed, we have a clearer sense of the number of exams in person and also online that each student has. And so the analytics team led by Professor David Schmoys is really working through that data right now to meet a number of really important outcomes, like front loading some exams so that we can start to move students out in that period before Thanksgiving in a gradual and purposeful way, avoiding conflicts, avoiding three exams in 2 hours, thinking about time zone issues. Of course, we have space limitations. I should say it's going to be inevitable for some larger classes to be spread out across multiple rooms. And so people should be prepared for that. But we're going to try to, of course, minimize that as much as possible. In terms of online testing, I know there are a lot of questions about that. And you know, as usual, I would recommend that people go to the CTI website for various tips. There are proctoring services available through a vendor called Examity, with whom we have a contract if people are interested in that. I've also heard some faculty are going to use Zoom to proctor exams, depending on the size of the class. You can use breakout rooms and pop into the different breakout rooms to answer questions and check in on students. But you know, proctoring may not be what faculty want to do. There are a lot of other things that can be done with online exams. And like I said, the tips are on the CTI website, but you know, begin by clearly articulating your academic integrity expectations, what can and cannot, you know, what students can and cannot do. Use the Canvas quizzes tool that can help you with the timed portion of the exam, randomizing test questions, making it so only one question shows up at a time, which makes it more difficult to snapshot and share. You can also make it so students can't backtrack. This is how exams like the GMATs are set up, and that can also be really helpful. We would recommend, though, that you test that tool before a high-stakes exam, just to make sure students understand how to use it and how to submit their exam so they don't run into a stressful situation on the day of a larger high stakes exam. So go to the CTI website for more specific tests on online exams.
Okay, thanks. Questions about study space for you, Lisa, and a couple different kinds of questions. The study space chatter app, can you talk about whether that can be revised to give more information upfront about what kinds of spaces are available, when they're free, what sort of amenities they have, and could a feature be added that allows someone to put a day and time period in and then have a list come up of available spaces? And related, could there be more spaces made available for studying or for taking online exams?
Yeah, you know, I'd like to just start by saying, I think all of you know, there was a ton of work that we needed to do in what felt like a very short 8 weeks to prepare the entire campus, build an alternate university, it felt like. And we had a lot of competing demands, and this was built, you know, in a very short period before the start of the semester to meet a pressing need for students to be able to book spaces. We've heard a lot of positive comments from students, which I really appreciate, you know, them saying they really appreciate being able to study in their favorite spot in their favorite library and feel safe about it. With that said, I know that it can be improved. We have received ideas, and I welcome more ideas for possible enhancements. But to be honest, we have so many competing priorities right now, including those that require CIT's attention, that we're in this tricky spot where we have to prioritize the things that are most important for safeguarding the health and safety of our community. So it's on our list. You know, the first thing we will do is finish the user interface so that space admins in the units can go in there and make edits to the spaces and rooms that are on there. And also very important and ongoing right now is clearing more small private rooms for students so they can use them for interviews and for taking exams and things like that. So all the units, thanks to all the units who are helping us to try to bring all that together across such a wide campus.
Wendy, let me just add to that you know, on Lisa's last point, one of the things obviously that we're doing now is doing the best that we can in a way in which we were really rushed to get the semester going. And I think we're doing a great job. But it does, I think, point out the opportunities now to think about the spring, think about how we can do an even better job in the spring when the conditions are likely to be very, very similar. So we're likely to have entrance testing of students coming back, testing of students, surveillance testing of students, social distancing, limited gatherings, et cetera, et cetera. And hopefully the results of what we've done so far will provide faculty and staff more confidence to be able to mount an even more successful spring semester.
Okay, thanks, Mike. There's a question here, and I think it's both Lisa, maybe Mike and Lauren, from Alice Suskind, Alex Suskind. There was an email warning yesterday from Daily Check that went out about students missing tests and the need to make sure they don't miss tests. Can one of you address that?
You want to take it, Lauren?
Yeah, I can comment on that. So as you know, participating in the surveillance program was part of the compact that the students signed. So it is an expectation. But as the whole testing program was developed, there were some conditions that needed to be met before that requirement could be enforced more strictly. So we need to make sure that the software system was working, that we knew who was here and who should be tested, that we had testing capacity, all those things. So the team is moving to next week to start turn on that function where there will it'll be a feedback loop to make sure students get tested if they haven't been. And as a precursor to that, the message was put out to the students that now we're moving into this next phase where that requirement will be enforced as we go forward.
I should add that we have had very good compliance from our students. The great, great majority of students have been tested. So if that's a worry, I should also correct, I think I mistakenly said that flu vaccine earlier was required for all faculty, staff, and students. It's required for students. It's highly recommended for faculty and staff.
Okay. Lisa, you want to jump in on that question too? No.
Okay. I think it's covered.
So now moving to some questions on finances for Mike. In the spring, you presented several potential financial impact models that were based on the cost of operating or not with COVID. Do you plan to present the financial outcomes of, now that we know, having operated this summer or going forward?
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. It's a little early to say for sure what's going on. We're planning in October full review. We now know what, obviously, for FY20, how we finished. We're seeing how this semester is going. So far, we're on our on track for our optimistic scenario. So I'm hopeful that we'll stay there. And I'd be glad. We've had some, you know, obviously expenses associated with COVID and testing and all the other elements of this. But I'd be glad to report, and I plan to do that to the University Finance Committee and the Faculty Senate sometime in the fall, and be glad to update as well in a town hall.
Okay, great. This is a related question. There seems to still be anger among some students that they're paying full tuition for less of an education. I put that in quotes. Is there a way to justify this to them? Can we explain what the costs of the college are and how we're putting in more hours to develop a large volume of high quality online learning experiences for students, and that is what some of their tuition is supporting?
Yeah, I mean, I think you stated it, Wendy, we are providing an outstanding semester for students under the conditions. I think Cornell, more than perhaps any of our peers, is providing that for all the students that want to experience an on-campus education, on-campus semester. There are extraordinary expenses associated with this. There are the expenses of investing in and building a lab and testing and all the supplies associated with testing, the change in facilities, the ventilation that we've put in place, the changes in classrooms, the technology that we put in classrooms, the equipment that Lisa has ordered to try and make the classrooms work better, all of those things. And we're providing the coursework and the credits that are necessary. So I think that's the best answer.
Okay. That's a good answer. And I really just read the whole text of the question there. So moving on to think about the spring then, and to ask some questions about what conditions will be like in the spring and whether we know what the academic calendar will be. Maybe I'll start with Lisa there and ask when we expect decisions to be made on the academic calendar and when those will be updated and posted on the website.
Sure. So, you know, we've, as Mike said, our conversations about the spring are well underway, and we are operating right now under the assumption that the spring semester will be, as we announced earlier in the summer, as Martha announced in our initial reopening plan, that is for the semester to begin February 9th. To begin in person and to remain hopefully in person for the entire semester. So students will have a bit of a longer break between the fall and spring semesters, but keep in mind that we want students to plan to be able to return here earlier than February 9th to be able to quarantine and do everything that we did all over again in that arrival process. We will be preparing a backup plan for just in case, because we don't know what we don't know, but in case the events at the time, the conditions at the time might require that we begin online and then bring students here for in-person, we don't want to be caught off guard, so we'll be preparing for that possibility, although we hope we won't have to go to that plan B.
Okay, thank you. And Mike, some more updates from you on how we're thinking about planning now, what the process is for planning for the spring semester.
Yeah, we have, Lisa and I just left, and Wendy just left a meeting that is a weekly meeting of all the implementation team leads. So this is facilities, it's curriculum, it's testing, it's staff, Mary Opperman's on the committee, and health and safety. So all of those we're continuing to work, and what we hope to do is provide, as Lisa said, a schedule as soon as possible about when we will when students can expect, for example, to be registering, and when we will have a course list, and all those things, and that we're hoping now to do in a much more timely way, so give people more time. But all of that is being worked on as we speak through the work of a number of teams. And as I said before, you know, really with a mind to trying lessons learned, what have we gotten out of this fall semester and how do we make it better? And I think, you know, some of that is feedback from our students like JT to try and say, okay, what's working, what's not working, how do we make it work better?
JT, can I hand it over to you to ask you your thoughts, not just about the spring semester, but also that really critical period from Thanksgiving to the start of classes again. Any thoughts you have of what you're hearing from students yourself about that sort of interim period, you know, mental health as you brought up in the beginning, and how students are planning to spend that time and how to address those concerns, and then your thoughts for the spring.
Absolutely. I think that this was a great implementation by the university to have that kind of bigger gap. Just from a mental health standpoint, just imagine, right, we're spending 24 hours a day in our apartments on Zoom classes all day. Now imagine if that was, you know, in the hardship of winter. That would be a very, very kind of a depressing sight. So I'm glad that we're able to go home, spend time with families. And I think from a mental health standpoint, from a refresh standpoint, that's going to give students a lot of energy and a lot of ability to re-engage. I think students are looking for ways. They're eager to learn, right? That makes Cornell students the brilliant students we are. They're eager to learn. So during those time periods, they're often looking for opportunities, externships, internships. And I know, so me being in the hotel school faculty and professors are amazing at being proactive and helping students find opportunities and connecting them. But I also think that if there's a way faculty can be intentional with ensuring that no matter what their discipline of study is, students have opportunities to engage over this period, over this long winter break, going into the spring, and have ways to learn, right? And maybe more courses, extra material, jobs. I think that's one of the key things. And as far as how we're looking at the spring, I think students are very, very excited for this spring. You know, of course, we would like some of the social distancing and other kind of protocols to be eased by that time, but we know that's based on, you know, the current climate of our environment from a safe and health standpoint. But I think that the biggest thing for this spring is just really allowing us to come back on campus, making sure everything goes smooth this fall, and kind of getting more back in person. I think that's the biggest feedback that I've received for the spring semester is, let's try to get a few more in-person classes. Now, we know that it won't be perfect and it won't be 100% most likely, but I just think that students are doing the best they can to abide by all the protocol, and we would love to kind of see that progress.
JT, I think you just spoke for all of us there. We'd all like to see more in-person everything in the spring. I'm going to turn to Lisa now with a couple questions from the Q&A. Based on what you were just talking about, Lisa, can you clarify when you said the spring semester will be in person with hybrid mode also, is that the case, or are we just waiting to see what will happen?
Yeah, so great question. You know, we anticipate that there will still be students who are participating in classes from overseas or elsewhere in the US and can only participate in classes remotely. And so getting rid of that option is, I don't think it's an option, right? So yes, I think planning for hybrid is the way to go. I know that it has been challenging for faculty in the classroom to manage both online students and students in the classroom. We're working to collect more information about faculty experiences, help share faculty experiences and strategies for dealing with that, also looking into technology and all the other things that can impact that. We are also talking about, you know, whether there are little tweaks that we can do to simplify some of those issues for faculty. So overall, I would say yes, hybrid, but there may be some refinements along the edges. We're talking about that right now and getting as much input as we can.
Can I add to that, Lisa? Is it, I know some faculty have talked about this idea of splitting where one faculty member does just in person and another faculty member does just in line so that we have the best. Are you hearing more of that conversation? Obviously, it won't work for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, we already did that this semester. We said that, you know, if you have an online version, then the in-person doesn't have to also have an online component. And so absolutely, if it's possible at the department level to do that, it's a great option, I think. And so we'd like to encourage departments, programs, colleges to strategize about ways to, you know, deliver the curriculum, absolutely.
Okay, I almost hate to ask you this question because I know the answer and it's not good. Lisa, will there be a spring break?
Well, you know, because of the risks associated with travel, right? This is the main thing. We know how important it is to have a break for a student, you know, wellness. But the travel introduces too many risks. And so consistent with the fall semester, the plan for the spring semester is that there will not be a study break, spring break. We will go all the way through, but we'll try to sprinkle in some days for that we might think of as self-care days where people do get to pause and take a deep breath. So it's an unfortunate reality of, you know, where we are right now.
Okay, thanks. A question for Lauren, I think, and maybe Mike could weigh in, from Ava Tardos. A recent email told us that faculty need to teach in masks and not in face shields. Can you comment if there's a safe enough distance in a large classroom where a shield would be okay?
You want me to comment, Mike?
Yeah, I think our best information now, public health information now, Ava, is it that the safest the safest way to interact with others in this way is to wear a mask. It is the best way to contain the aerosolization of virus. And while I certainly recognize the point of your question, and at some distance, you know, there has to be sufficient safety, but we just don't have enough information about that. And the best public health recommendations are to wear a mask and prevent virus aerosolization, as I say.
I can also add, you know, in conversations that I've had with Tompkins County Health Department in relation to cases that have come up, that we've talked about this issue, what we heard was that, you know, if a faculty member were, if they were wearing a shield instead of a mask, that students in the first and possibly second row might be considered, right, close contacts. And that this is going, the reason it's so hard to give a clear answer is that this really does depend on so many factors. The rooms are set up very differently. So where the faculty member is relative to students, both in distance and the angles and all of that is quite different, and the kind of interaction. And so we couldn't get a precise, right, distance to be able to share, but the overall guidance, as Mike said, masks are superior.
Okay, thanks. Lauren, you're not getting out of it. So I have two questions for you. One is the follow-up on missing tests, please, if you can address that. And the second one is, can you talk about USDA staff working in Cornell buildings? Who are they required to participate in the COVID-19 testing?
Yeah, thanks. So on there were a lot of questions initially about what do you do if tests are missed and that kind of thing. And I did want to let people know that for students, there's already an option in the daily check to put in a time frame where they would be unavailable for testing for some reason. And that's also under development for employees. So watch for that as a future option within the daily check. So that's upcoming. My understanding is that people who are working on campus, whether they're directly Cornell employees or not, but say they're USDA employees, vendors that are here on a daily basis and so on, have been added into the surveillance program. And so they should be under the same criteria for surveillance as Cornell employees working on campus. And if there's a specific question about that where some group was overlooked or weren't enrolled or something like that, we'd be happy to follow up and make sure they get added to the program.
Okay, thanks. Mike, you answered this question already in the Q&A, but I wondered if you wanted to elaborate at all. The testing has been so successful, Lauren's lab, and the work of a lot of people on campus. There is a question here about assisting the Ithaca City School District or other local universities, TC3, et cetera, helping to monitor their population or helping with testing. Can you address what we're able to do and what the conversation is around that?
Yeah, we've had a number of conversations. I've spoken to the Ithaca City School District's school board, as is Joel Molina. I've spoken with the superintendent and others. We're trying to work out ways in which we can help. Obviously, our number one priority is to keep Cornell safe, working effectively. It's the best thing we can do for our community and our students. But we do have some testing capacity, and many of you know that Ithaca City School District is the only school district that is not open right now in our surrounding region, and they're planning on open in early October. But there's been a number of legitimate concerns, I think, by faculty and staff in the district that the proximity to Cornell and the uncertainty about Cornell has raise some anxiety about the ability to open safely. And so we think it's the responsible thing to do to try and address that to the extent that we can. And we're now talking with a committed group of faculty. Many are, interestingly, the same group of faculty that we've relied on to do our modeling, to do our PCR analysis, et cetera, are now helping and talking with the Ithaca City School District and scaling what we can do. It's a complicated arrangement because it means involving Cayuga Health System, our partner hospital, which is partnering with the lab, getting that information into their database, which is how all this student testing and faculty and staff testing is working. And then getting those reports to Tompkins County Health Department, of course. But we think all that is doable. We're working on it, and please stay tuned for some announcements about how we might be able to help.
Thanks, Mike. That's great. I am gonna let JT take us out here. Any final comments, final closing remarks, JT?
Absolutely. One, I just wanna say thank you to everyone on this call. Thank you to all of the educators, faculty, professors, staff, and administrators. Cornell, and I said this over and over again, has changed my life as a young man and as a student. I know it does that for every young person who steps on this campus. And the work that you all are doing, you know, very, very important. I know sometimes you all don't get thanked enough. So on behalf of, you know, all the young people on the campus, thank you for what you do. Thank you for coming to work and essentially, you know, risking your lives. I know professors who have in-person classes are dealing with a lot of different things, but you're still here, you're educating students, and it means a lot. And then the last thing I just want to say is, you know, we're all one big family. We're a community. We're all in this together, students, staff, faculty, administrators, and we need to just keep that at the forefront of our mind, right? And try to do the little things like being caring, being kind, especially with everything that's going on in the world today. We're under a lot of pressure, but I just think if we stay together, we keep pushing forward, we'll come out of this a lot better than we were going in. So thank you all for being here. Thank you everything for what you do for the university.
Thanks, JT.
Thank you, JT.
I'll just say we got a lot of great questions, so we will copy these and we'll try to respond to people as we can. Thanks, everyone.